Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Fake TV Critic, a podcast where I discuss the week's biggest TV news headlines, recap and analyze some of my favorite shows, and let you know what you should be watching. We're really close to a deal between SAG and the AMPTP. I'm recording once again on Sunday morning, and as of yesterday, I think it was the studios had delivered an offer to SAG after negotiating all of last week and getting really close. And today, and I think maybe tomorrow, the guild is supposed to be looking at the offer and responding. So fingers crossed that we may have a resolution this week, hopefully, because it's bleak, dude. Like, I sat down to record this podcast today and I'm like, what the fuck am I even going to talk about? I've literally already discussed everything I watch. And like, I mean, I can always go back and be like, this is what's happened on, you know, The Masked Singer or Survivor or Real Housewives or whatever. But I mean, part of the reason that I started this podcast in the first place was to talk about the things that, like, talk about new things, you know? Like, if I want to talk about Real Housewives, I can go to people I know in my real life that watch Real Housewives. This was supposed to be like a sounding board for the stuff that I watch that maybe other people out yonder in the world might be watching, but that the people that I talk to on a regular basis aren't. And I'm like literally at the end of my rope. not in a bad way, but like I'm done talking. Like there's nothing else to talk about. I don't really have time to watch or to catch up on things that I have missed, even though there's stuff that I do want to watch. Like Amazon has Gen V, the Boys spinoff. I want to watch that. Now that that season's over, I want to binge it. But there's just not a lot of other stuff to watch. There's not a lot on TV. And yeah, so there was a new show that I have started that I'm going to talk about today called Fellow Travelers, and I'll get to that. But I'm like, I feel like I'm out of TV to talk about. So let's get this strike resolved so that some shit can happen. Yeah, and also speaking of the strike, because of that, HBO this week announced a new timeline for a lot of its shows because of impacts from the writers and now the actors' strikes. And basically, they're not airing anything in the year 2024. So because of how long the shutdown has been, we're getting almost no new HBO content until 2025. So like, as much as I complained about Max, I just paid for another year, which I'll also maybe get to that in a little bit. I paid for another year in September because the Gilded Age came back, which I could talk about that too, but that's so complicated. I feel like I would need a whole podcast just to talk about that to parse out who all the damn characters are, to watch the Gilded Age and the new True Detective. And True Detective got kicked back to January. It was supposed to be on now. And Gilded Age is currently airing. So once those two are aired, I don't know what the hell is going to be on HBO until 2025. Euphoria is not coming back until then. House of Dragons, I don't watch either of those, but it's the principle of the thing. and everything that they renewed, or The Last of Us, all of these shows are not coming back until 2025 at the earliest. And I guess because of that nothing's been made, that there's no new shows that they were going to premiere. So unless we're getting a whole bunch of like documentaries or something, there goes that. So we need this strike to be over so we can get some stuff back on our little television sets or on our phones or tablets, wherever the hell we actually watch TV nowadays, because apparently it's not on TVs. Speaking of all of this, I did some calculations this week because Dragula, which I can't remember if I've talked about like in detail on the podcast before, but is a drag TV series, kind of like Drag Race. Like it's aped the format of Drag Race, obviously, which is just aped from Project Runway and America's Next Top Model and et cetera, et cetera. But it's for queens that focus on horror or not necessarily trying to be like female passing or you know, that they use like filth and glamour. The tenants are horror, filth, glamour. So like, you know, that they can look pretty, but they can also be disgusting and dirty. So, and they call themselves monsters. And I love it. And the season just started last week on Shudder, but I haven't watched it yet because I don't want to pay for another streaming service. So I was doing some mathing a little bit ago when HBO announced all of these shows that were not coming back until 2025. And it's insane how much money streaming services cost. So I also realized maybe the week before last that I no longer get Netflix. So my boss from when my high school job until I graduated with my master's, I worked at this job from 2006 until 2014. And my boss at this job was one of the first people I knew to get Netflix, like in 2012, I think it was. So I was using her account and she just always let me use it. And then after the office that we worked in closed, I would help her. Like, she worked in a new office and I would go down every once in a while to help her. And now she started her own business and I would help her with that. But rather than take money from her, because it wasn't like I was working, you know, like 8 or 10 hours a week, it would be like a half an hour here and, you know, 15 minutes there, an hour there, that she just let me stay on her Netflix account. So since 2012, I have been using my old boss's Netflix account. And now that they've done this crackdown, it finally hit me and they want me to make my own account. And like, my boss lives over an hour away. Like, I'm never going to take my Roku with me and connect it to her Wi-Fi so that I can seem like I'm part of her family. So it wants me to create my own account and I haven't done it because I already pay for all this other shit. And the lowest level of Netflix with ads is still $7 a month. And which doesn't sound like a whole lot, but it is when you add on everything else. So like, here's what I pay for currently. I pay for WoW Presents Plus to watch all the international drag races. That's $5 a month. I pay for Peacock, which is my only, I was thinking about this the other day, this is my only must-have. Of all of the streaming services, this is the one that I could not live without, between Hallmark at this time of year, Bravo all year long, and they really do have good originals. That's $6 a month. I have Prime Video because I get Amazon Prime. And now I don't use Amazon Now as much as I used to because I'm trying not to. But that, if you break down like what I pay for Prime in a year, is like $10 a month. And that goes towards Prime Video because I don't use the music anymore because they changed the format and that sucks. And like I said, I maybe do one package a month from Amazon Now. So the free shipping isn't really all that worth it. But also, Amazon just announced a few weeks ago that starting in 2024, they are going to charge extra if you want Prime Video without ads. So Jesus. So I'm basically paying $10 a month for Prime with ads. So I have $5 for WoW Presents, $6 for Peacock, $10 for Prime, $10 for Max, and that's with ads, and $6 for Paramount Plus, that's also with ads. So I am paying for 5 services on my own. A bunch of my friends use both Max and my Paramount Plus. My parents use my Peacock, and I have another friend who uses my WoW Presents Plus, the only one that I think everyone has Prime, so no one uses that. Now, I also use a friend's Hulu and Disney Plus accounts. And I barely watch Disney Plus. I'll start next week when the Santa Clauses comes out. But other than that, I do not watch Disney Plus. I need to watch my Home Alone and my Hocus Pocus once a year. And that's the end of my Disney Plus needs. Mostly because, like I'm about to get to, all of these streaming services are like, there's nothing on them that makes it worth it. So I pay $37 a month for streaming services. And I don't even come close to having all the services that I want. I don't have Netflix. I don't have Apple. I don't have Shudder. I have Hulu and Disney Plus, but I don't pay for them. Like, it's wild. So if I wanted to get Netflix, Apple, and Shudder, for example, it would be another $23 a month minimum. That's over $50 a month that I will be paying just in streaming services. And for how sporadically a lot of these services release content, it's not worth it at all. And then let's say my friend just cancels her Hulu plus Disney Plus, that's another $7 to $15 a month that I'll be adding on to that to get those. It's fucking insanity. And then rather than like making it worth our while, these services just keep like upping the prices of the service and not adding content. Like I just mentioned, Max has no original content in production currently. Zero. And HBO has Gilded Age right now and True Detective coming out. That's it. That's all that they have. They have no plans past like March or February of 2024. Paramount Plus just canceled this week, because I haven't talked about cancellations in a while. Three shows: Joe Pickett, Rabbit Hole, and Fatal Attraction. I don't know if you remember this, but Fatal Attraction was one of the very first series Paramount Plus announced before they even launched, and it lasted one season. So they're canceling shows, they're taking content away, and charging more for it, or making you watch more ads. It's ridiculous. Rather than like putting new content on there, all of these services are now depending on their backlog. Like, Netflix has so many customers because they have such a balance of old content, like a catalog, and new shit that they're always coming out with. These other services don't have that. They just, they can't keep up. And it's gonna bite them in the ass at some point. Like I said, I do not have Netflix right now. And I may buy it like a month at a time when I want to and just binge everything. Apple, I really want to watch that new Godzilla show that's coming out in a couple weeks, but I'm not paying. They just upped the price to $10 a month. It went from like $6, I think, to $10 a month for Apple, and they have zero back catalog. And like, I want to watch Dracula, but I don't want to pay $6 a month for Shudder, and because it's going to be on the air for at least 3 months. That's $18 to watch one TV show. And why does that piss me off? Because I started watching Dracula when it used to be on Prime, and then they moved. So I used to watch it for quote unquote free because it was on a service I already had. Now I have to buy a new service just to watch that one thing. It's absolutely insane. And I don't, and now at this point, like with the strike going on for so long and these new deals being in place, I wonder how much it's even going to matter, because I wonder how much content these services are even going to be ordering when the time comes for them to do it. I'm frustrated. Anyway, so also canceled this week, besides those ones from Paramount Plus, since I haven't done these in a while, Netflix canceled some show called Wellmania, which I've never heard of, but it's Australian apparently. And the creator was ridiculous and went online and was like complaining about how awful Hollywood is because they didn't give her a second season, and then said something, they told me it's something about the numbers, which, yes, that is how anyone, broadcast network, streaming service, cable, doesn't matter. They need people to watch your show in order for them to spend money on it. So, yep, something about the numbers. And the CW said that this upcoming season of Superman and Lois, which was one of the few shows to survive the regime change over there, is going to be its last. That'll be season 4 coming up whenever the hell that actually happens. All right. So I mentioned this week, I want to talk about Fellow Travelers. This is on Showtime, which, again, is another service that I don't pay for because my parents pay for it and I use their account. But if I did want it, it would be another $5 a month to add on to my Paramount Plus. So do with that what you will. But if you do have Paramount Plus with Showtime, or you get Showtime, this show is on that. And it is... you may have seen some shit about it on the internet because it's been getting a lot of attention. It premiered a little over a week ago, and it's been getting a lot of attention in that first week for its depiction of hot gay sex, because it's Matt Bomer, who everyone has a crush on. Like, I literally don't care who you are. I don't care what your gender or sexual identity is. Everyone has a crush on Matt Bomer. He's human perfection. You look at him and you're like, you are a literal Disney prince. He looks like Prince Eric from the animated Little Mermaid come to life. He takes off his shirt and he has like the perfect airbrushed, but they're real abs and pecs. He has the perfect chin, the beautiful eyes. He's talented. He's like, he's perfect. Everyone is in love with him. Don't care who you are. And he has a bunch of sex scenes with another real hot man whose name is Jonathan Bailey, and he's British, and he's mostly a stage actor. But he is also going to be in the new Wicked movie that's coming out. Is it still coming out next year? I think it's still coming out next year. The first part, I think, is still coming out next year. And he was in Bridgerton. And he is openly gay in life, but and he and Matt Bomer play a couple, and they get it on a lot in this first episode. And it is, there is one scene in particular where Jonathan Bailey's character Tim has sex with Matt Bomer's character Hawk, or Hawkins. And the power dynamic that's in play is like not anything new. It's very recognizable. It's a little, it's fetishy. It's a little BDSM, but very light. Like there's no like bondage or anything. So maybe it's a little like it's sub-dom. It's not like, you know, like getting tied up and shit. It's a little sub-dom. It's a little foot fetish. And Jonathan Bailey puts Matt Bomer's entire foot in his mouth. And you have no idea what the show is about, but you now know that there's kink sex in it. And this scene is shocking in that we don't typically see fetish play like that at all, like across the board in mainstream TV or movies. Straight, gay, bi, pan, whatever. We never see shit like that, but especially in gay things. And my theory is that because so much of it is not so much of it, like 90% of queer content is made with a heterosexual lens. Like, even if it's an entirely queer cast and director and writer, blah, 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 they know as they're making it that if they're putting this show or movie or whatever it is on a series, on a streaming service like Showtime or Paramount Plus, or that it's like a Brokeback Mountain situation where it's released in theaters, that they are relying on a straight audience to see it. So because it's shot like through this lens or for the gaze of, going back to my master's days, because it's shot with the heterosexual gaze, that it's never, we don't really explore what gay sex really looks like. And as a person who has gay sex, the way it's portrayed is like, even when it's by queers for queers, like way back in the day when I was in college, I used to watch a lot of like TLA releasing and Wolf Video movies. And even then it was very unrealistic where like, I don't know, there's the other sex scene in Fellow Travelers, and this is across the board in other stuff. Like you probably have seen the scene where it's like two men and they're laying front to back and they're like gyrating as if they're having sex. Like just think logistically, that makes no sense. How are they getting, how are they penetrating? That was a word I bet you didn't expect to hear at 7 a.m. driving to work. How are they penetrating when they're just like flat back to front, laying in a bed, clutching each other? That makes no sense. So at least in Fellow Travelers, when they did that, they were jerking each other off. Again, bet you didn't expect to hear this. I hope you don't have your kids in the car. Where the fuck was I? Jerking each other off. Why am I talking about this? Anyway, that like that's the type of sex that you see in, or that like I'm thinking in my favorite movies of all time is All Over the Guy. I fucking love that movie. And it's there's a gay couple, and it's directed by a straight woman, but it's written by and starring at least one gay man and another straight one who is super hot and does porn now. Richard Ruccolo, look him up. He's from Jersey and mwah, beautiful. Anyway, when the scene where they finally have sex, like they're in missionary position and like looking directly into each other's eyes and saying, I love you as they're like humping. Not realistic. Gay sex is much more similar to what Fellow Travelers is presenting. And I'm glad that in the year 2023, we might be having our rights taken away and challenged. And in one of two dominant political parties in our country, maybe making all gay people are pedophiles part of their official platform. But at least we're seeing realistic portrayals of gay sex. Yeah. So like the scene, so if you have seen stuff, this, I'm all over the place and I haven't even really started yet. So if you have seen shit on the internet about like these gay sex scenes, that's what they're talking about. Jonathan Bailey sucking Matt Bomer's toes. Anyway, I'll get back to that when I get to the story. The actual show itself, Fellow Travelers, it's based on a book by Thomas Malan that came out, Malan, I don't know how you say his name, came out, I want to say like 5 or 6 years ago, maybe more. And I was aware of this book, never read it. It's, and I'm seeing this in the show also, it is a romance that is disguised as a historical drama. And for this particular type of show, I'm more drawn to the historical drama than the romance. Like, I don't know if I've talked about this. I've been doing this so long that I preface everything by saying I don't know if I've talked about this in the podcast. My apologies. But I used to write gay romance. When was my last story published? Like, maybe, what year is it? 7 years ago was my last story was published, and both of my publishers, well, one of them went under completely, and the other one started stealing money from their authors. So that was fun. So I don't have anything in circulation anymore, but like for a while I was pumping out a lot of like novellas and short stories and stuff. And I was reading a lot of them because I was with this publisher that I wanted to know my fellow authors and whatnot. So having written and read a lot of it, I'm not drawn to it anymore. I'm over it. So I am more interested in the historical drama aspect. And this book came out and it was mostly criticized because, or the criticisms of it were mostly that the historical drama was the interesting part, but it focused on the romance. And I really hope that the creators and writers of this show have fixed that going forward. So it's written by Ron Nyswaner. Don't know how to say his name, but he's the guy who wrote Philadelphia. He got nominated for an Oscar for writing Philadelphia back in the 90s, the movie where Tom Hanks has AIDS and Denzel Washington's his lawyer. And it's directed by Daniel Minahan, and he's done like stuff like The L Word and Grey's Anatomy and a bunch of other stuff. Like, he did a lot of episodes of Game of Thrones and True Blood. And they are both gay men, and both Matt Bomer and Jonathan Bailey, who are the leads, are gay men. So, like, this is they're doing it right. I'll give them that much right there. And it follows these two, and it charts their romance across a whole like a slew of decades. Okay, starts in DC in the 1950s, and Hawkins Fuller, goes by Hawk, is Matt Bomer, and he works for the senator from Pennsylvania in DC. And he is gay, but it's the 50s, and he works in politics. What that means is he meets men in public park restrooms for sex, typically, or picks them up on the street and pays them for their silence any slew of things to cover his tracks. And he, by chance, an election night party, the night Joe McCarthy is elected, he meets Tim, who wrote about McCarthy's campaign for Senate in New York, and thought that meant that he would be able to get a job in DC, but he can't. So they meet at this party. Tim orders a glass of milk and Hawk orders a scotch, and then they keep running into each other, and then eventually they start a sexual relationship that starts to bloom into something else. Like, Hawk gets Tim a job working for McCarthy, and in the meantime, it's, you know, the McCarthyism witch hunt is starting, where they're, you know, hunting out the Reds, quote unquote. And, you know, a bunch of people are on trial, and Roy Cohn, and like behind the scenes, everyone's a big flaming fag, but they're trying to cover it up by looking for these deviants and communists and stuff. And by the end of the first episode, we get the beginning of the Lavender Scare, which is, to me, one of the most fascinating parts of American history in general, but especially queer American history, and we almost never talk about it. I can't think of any movies or TV shows that even are set during it or that mention it. I was in a play last year called Perfect Arrangement, and that was about the Lavender Scare. It was a comedy about two gay men and two gay women who marry each other's partners and live next door to each other to keep up appearances, and their houses are connected by the closet. That's how they go back and forth. Very cute, very funny, but also very real, because by the end of the episode, McCarthy and Roy Cohn, who was also depicted in Angels in America, start the Lavender Scare, where they're going to hunt out quote-unquote sexual deviants from the U.S. government work and, you know, basically make sure that they can never work again. And the way that they did this was they would go through police records of men who were arrested in public restrooms for like lewd displays or public exposure, things like that. And they would question them and threaten their jobs and say, you know, like, it doesn't matter if you are gay, we can still fire you for this because the implication is there. Give us names. And they would give each other up. Like, they would give up their tricks or their Johns or their friends or people that they didn't know. Like, in this episode, Hawk gives up a guy named Eddie that he has a one-night stand with to help save a senator who's in the hot seat. And this is how it went. And, like, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people lost their jobs because of it. One of them was Frank Kameny, who, if you don't know who he is, he's probably the most prominent figure, and his history is being told a little more often lately, thanks to a bestseller by Eric Cervini from a few years ago called The Deviant's War. And he worked as an astronomer for the Army, and he was fired because he was groped in a San Francisco bathroom. And, you know, he was gay, but that's what he was arrested for, and they used that to fire him, and he appealed, and it was denied. So then he started the DC branch of the Mattachine Society, which you may have heard of also. That was part of, like, this, they were a part of the scene during Stonewall and all that. I'm so sorry. I did not mean for this to be a history lecture, but hopefully you're learning something. My apologies for that. Anyway, and then he went on to testify, not to testify, to work with the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, to remove homosexuality as a classification of mental disorder. So he is the reason that I'm no longer considered mentally ill because of Frank Kameny. He also ran for Congress and did not win the election. He had a very long life, thankfully. He later, after, you know, after the 70s, when he, like, you know, he testified. Why do I keep saying the word testified too? God, I'm sorry. I'm all over the place. After he worked with the APA to get homosexuality removed from its ranks, and he ran for Congress and the Mattachine Society, all that shit, he became an activist for DC statehood. And he passed away in 2011 at the age of 86. But he is one of the most prominent examples of a person who was fired during this Lavender Scare. And it's a really fascinating part of history. And again, we don't really talk about it very much. But to see this romance kind of playing out with that as the backdrop is tragic, right? And we know that it's not going to end well for everyone. So there's that element of suspense going through it. And then on top of that, we have Matt Bomer, who is not only the most attractive person on the earth, but he is such a good actor. And he plays cold and aloof, but still charming so well. You know, that's his bread and butter. If you go back to, like, White Collar and shit like that, is that he, like, is so beautiful that he draws you in, but then he also keeps it at an arm's length while flirting and making you feel like you're not. Oh, it's so good. So he does that whole shtick here in Fellow Travelers. And Jonathan Bailey, I've never seen him in something before. The kid is damn wonderful. And I say kid, he's probably older than I am. He is wonderful on this show. He is acting circles around everyone. Not that anyone else is doing poorly, but he is just like, God damn, he knows who Tim is. And he's like a lapsed Catholic, or he's a Catholic, and that's why he wants to work for McCarthy, even though he knows that Catholicism says he can't be gay. So then when he has sex with Hawk, he knows that he shouldn't be doing it, and then it's a mortal sin, but also he never has felt more pure. And, like, he has these explosive scenes where, like, it's not, like, yelling and stuff like we think of explosive. It's all internal, and you can, like, see it bubbling inside of him. It's so fucking good. And it's bookended by the scenes in the 1980s. So their love story starts in the 50s, and we know that it ends prior to 1986, I think it is, when Hawk gets a visit from a mutual friend of his and Tim's from back then, Marcus, that Tim has AIDS and that he's going to die in San Francisco, and he needs Hawk to go visit him, wants Hawk to talk to him. And so Hawk goes to San Francisco to visit him, and understandably, even based on the little bits that we've seen from the 50s, Tim does not want to see him. So now the rest of the episodes, the next 7 episodes, are going to kind of fill in those blanks of what happens from 1952 or 3, whatever, whenever this first episode in the past starts, 1986. So we have, like, a 35-year journey with this couple. And I'm really excited for that, but also kind of disappointed. Like I said, there's not a whole lot of queer content in particular that spans this time period of the 50s. We get a lot more of it in the 60s and 70s, if only because people started pushing boundaries and, you know, free love and civil rights and all that, that we started to actually see representations of queerness in the 60s and 70s. And I'm thinking, you know, like we had Larry Kramer coming around and writing Faggots, and we had, and then making movies like Women in Love with the naked wrestling scene. And we had A Very Natural Thing and Harvey Milk running for office in real life, that like there was more visibility. And then since then, we've also had representations of that. And like I mentioned, Brokeback Mountain, that takes place in the 60s. Milk, you know, it's about Harvey Milk. And we've started to, and you know, then the 70s is when it exploded. That's when we get like Cabaret and Poison the Band and again, Larry Kramer. And then the 80s, when we started to see the proliferation of AIDS and all the content that surrounded that. And we have more representation of what was going on in the 60s, 70s, and 80s than we do with the 50s. So I'm a little sad to move away from that time period. But also, like, I'm invested in these characters. And not because of their romance, but because of their place in this history is where I'm coming from. But all of that aside, we get a lot of really, really unheard of, like I mentioned, in a lot of ways, character development for queer characters. Like the dynamic between Hawk and Tim, we know is unbalanced. Hawk works for a senator. Tim is unemployed when they meet. Hawk then gets Tim a job, and he's also using Tim for information on McCarthy because Tim works there. So there's like a symbiotic relationship, but also a parasitic one in some ways. And it's clear that Hawk is the dominant person in this relationship. He's been out and queer and having sex longer. He knows how to navigate both the politics and the underground scenes of DC, whereas Tim doesn't because he just moved there. And it's kind of like this mentor-mentee relationship while they're also forming a sexual and romantic relationship while they're also in a professional relationship. So there's a lot of levels to their pairing to explore. And one of the ways that they do that is through the sex scenes. Like I mentioned, they're not graphic. There's no nudity. There's not even a butt. No, not even a butt yet. But yeah. However, in that first sex scene, it's meant to portray like the, and this is the one where they're front to back, and like, I'll try to use less graphic terms. Hawk is manually stimulating Tim while they're laying in bed, and the scene is really quick, and that's on purpose because it's meant to, you know, portray this shame and this release that Tim has. Is like he's never experienced it, or he hasn't experienced such a long time or so openly, that it spews out of him literally and figuratively very quickly. And then it's also meant, you know, when Hawk is undressing him, they talk about the crucifix that Tim wears and why he believes in what he does. And then afterward, he's staring at an icon of the Virgin Mary, and Hawk says, you know, we'll turn her toward the wall next time, because Hawk understands the shame and the indoctrination that's come with who Tim is. So and then the second sex scene is the foot fetish scene, and that is meant to show the domination and the dominance, rather, that Hawk has over Tim, and also that Hawk feels in his everyday life, this kind of untouchable, I'm the boss, I'm in charge. They call each other like, Hawk is like, you know, you're my good boy, or you're my little boy, or you're my boy, whatever it is, boy. Boy is the word that they use to establish that, you know, father-son dynamic, that mentor-mentee, that big brother-little brother, the lack of balance there is purposeful. Hawk is meant to be in this dominant position. That is what their relationship is built upon. And I'm sure that will come into play throughout the series, even just based on the bookends that we get, that Hawk is the one who calls the shots. He's in charge. Tim is kind of following along. And with the, like, stripping off the sock and sucking on his feet, like, that is very submissive behavior. It's also very religious in its iconography, I guess is the word for it. But, you know, the whole Maundy Thursday is the humility of washing each other's feet. And that's exactly, you know, that's what Tim does. He's just washing the feet with his mouth. There's also a shorter scene of, like, actual, you know, that, like, of, you know, penetration or whatever. And, like, just the way that the sex isn't gratuitous, it's meant to portray something and it's meant to mean something. And we never see that in queer movies and TV. It's so powerful to display queer affection in a way that also develops a queer character. Because so often queer sexuality is used as, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is. It's used to kind of demean the character, or it's only used shamefully, or, you know, like, especially in a historical film like this. Like, if you think about Brokeback Mountain, like, that sex scene is very rough, and it's meant to be. Because that's the symbolism there, is that they have a rough road and it's only going to be bloodier and grosser as they go along it. And the gruffness kind of foreshadows what their relationship is. It's kind of the same thing here, where we're using the sex and the way the sex happens to develop character. And that, even in heterosexual stuff, like, you don't usually see, when you see sex scenes, it's because they just want you to know this is a couple who has this connection and that's the end of it. Or it's meant to be titillating or whatever. In this show, it's both. It is meant to be both titillating and meaningful. The creator of the show, again, what is his name? Because I can't pronounce it. Is Ron Nyswaner? Sure. Anyway, he did an interview where he was like, I want people to be turned on by that sex scene with the feet. Like, I want straight men watching this to be like, gay sex looks kind of hot. Because that's not only is that scene really hot, but we never explore that aspect. It's always done in a way that is meant to either shame the characters, like make the audience feel bad for them, feel repulsed by them, feel uncomfortable, again, like in Brokeback Mountain. Or it's meant to signal something that, like, oh my God, you have to watch out. Like, later on, this is going to come back and one of them is going to have AIDS or gonorrhea or something. And for this to just be like a pure part of this relationship is what sex actually is in relationships. I've talked so much about the symbolism of the sex on this show, but for every great thing, like, this still, it's not a perfect show. For every great thing they do like that, there are some very strange choices. Like, Allison Williams from Girls and Get Out and Megan plays Hawk's eventual wife, Lucy, and she looks utterly absurd in the age makeup in the 1980s scenes. And then there's also some really questionable makeup on Chris Bauer, who was Andy on True Blood and has been in a whole bunch of other shit. But True Blood is what I remember him for most. He was also in, like, The Wire and some other stuff. But he plays Joseph McCarthy, and they make him look, like, they give him, like, a really square face and a giant nose. And he looks, if you've ever seen the movie Across the Universe, the Beatles musical movie by Julie Taymor, the Uncle Sam soldiers with the deformed faces, that's what they made him look like. Like, he looks like a Lego face. It's very square. It's strange. It's super strange. And all to make him look more like McCarthy, when who fucking cares? Like, I do not care if these people look like Roy Cohn or Joseph McCarthy or whoever. You know, like, just play the damn part. It's weird. But yeah, this the show airs on Sunday nights on Showtime, and new episodes are on Friday on Paramount Plus with Showtime. And it's fascinating. It is, and also hot. And I didn't even know it existed until I saw something on Twitter about the gay sex scene. So I'm glad that I found it, and hopefully maybe you are now interested and want to watch it as well. Or at the very least, go look up the foot fetish scene, because like I said, it's hot. It's good. It's fun. Okay, that's Fellow Travelers. All right, let's wrap this mother up. So my Hallmark Countdown to Christmas recommendation. Guys, I need to apologize, because if you are watching or like DVRing or even just like putting things in your watch list because I've recommended them based on this podcast, I'm so sorry, because this year's crop of Hallmark movies has been really bad. I stand behind a recommendation for this past weekend. Never Been Kissed was a lot of fun. It was unexpected. It was not about a polyamorous relationship like I had hoped. But it was very much like the first 45 minutes to an hour were very much like a rom-com, not like a strict romance, which is what most of these Hallmark movies, especially Christmas movies, tend to be. It was a comedy first and foremost. It was more calm than rom. And I appreciated that. And then it kind of like lost the thread a little bit in the middle, but I think it ended in a really great place where the romance was absolutely not the focus. It was very much about these two friends and what their relationship was and is and will be in the future. And I thought that was very nice. And that newcomer girl, whose name I can't remember, was really funny. And yeah, it was a weird, quirky, but really cute movie. I really liked it. But other than that, Jesus, man, these movies have been bad. They have been very old school. And I mean, like, they feel like they're out of 2014, not even like 2019, 2020 Hallmark, like 2014, where it is just girl comes home from the big city to a small town, does a little project, falls in love and leaves her job to move in with the dude that she just met. And the dude is gruff and an asshole and hates Christmas, and she has to make him fall in love with it. Like Flipping for Christmas this past week, trash. Christmas by Design, trash. Like they are bad this year. And I don't even just mean like, oh, I don't like them as much as last year. No, like they are straight up not good. I'm hopeful that Never Been Kissed is a turning point and that we are going to get more fun moving forward, more unique moving forward. But I do not have high hopes. So, okay, this week's movies on Thursday on Miracles of Christmas on the Hallmark Movies and Mysteries channel. Thursday, November 9th, Mystery on Mistletoe Lane. New to town, Heidi Wicks and her kids discover a Christmas mystery in their historic home. Local handyman and historian David helps along the way, finding his own surprising connection. Now, okay, it's a Christmas mystery. Cool. I've seen the commercials during this weekend, and basically it's like the people who lived in this house before were obsessed with Christmas, and there's a mystery, but there's no hint as to what the mystery is, so it's probably terrible. That's on Thursday. So on Friday, just judging by the title of this, I know I'm going to hate it. Everything Christmas. Lori Jo's love for Christmas takes her on a road trip to Yuletide Springs with her roommate Tori, where Christmas is celebrated year-round, to participate in a long-standing town tradition to honor her late grandmother. No thank you. Saturday, Christmas Island. When a snowstorm diverts Kate's first private flight en route to Switzerland to Christmas Island, she must team up with an air traffic controller to secure her dream job as the family's pilot. Dude, no thank you. And then finally, a Heidelberg holiday on Sunday. Heidi Heidelberg. I can't believe that's her. Woo. Heidi Heidelberg reserves... This might have to be the recommendation just because I'll giggle every time they say her stupid fucking name. Heidi Heidelberg receives the dream opportunity to sell her beautiful handmade glass ornaments at the prestigious Heidelberg Christmas Market in Germany. While there, she meets Lucas, a local artisan who helps her reconnect with her lost heritage. Guys, these all sound fucking terrible. Like, these all sound so bad. I don't even know which one to recommend. I mean, a Heidelberg holiday is at least set in Germany and it was filmed in Germany. So I kind of want to see what they do with that. But then again, I recommended Joyeux Noël because they filmed it in France and that was kind of trashy and did not need to be filmed in France. They could have filmed on any backlot and it would have looked the same. I mean, it wasn't terrible. It was actually one of the better ones, which is how bad this group of films is. So maybe I shouldn't recommend it based solely on its location, but she's going to sell ornaments? Who fucking cares? And then Christmas Island, a private pilot, crash lands on Christmas Island where she teams up with an air traffic controller to get a dream job as a family's private pilot. Holy fuck. Also, I don't know where Christmas Island is supposed to be because she's going to Switzerland, but where did she divert from? Is this in Europe somewhere? It looks like Maine. Like in the previews, they show a lobster trap Christmas tree, which is a Maine thing. That looks cute. If nothing else, like that tree, lobster trap tree they showed looks cute. I'm going to do Christmas Island. That's going to be my recommendation. The one on Saturday, November 11th. Christmas Island. One, I like the cast. It's Rachel Skarsten and Andrew Walker. And Rachel Skarsten did one of the more ambitious but not totally successful ones last year, The Royal Nanny, where she was a British intelligence agent who went undercover to protect some royal children from a terrorist threat. Wild plot, I know, but it swung for the fences. Didn't always knock it out of the park, but more good than bad and a fun swing. And she was also Alice on Batwoman, which I loved, and she was great on that. And she was in Rain, the CW Royal show. And then Andrew Walker, who is adorable but also tends to make more bad than good Christmas movies for Hallmark, I think. Like, I'm trying to remember, the only one of his I've liked is the one last year, Three Wise Men and a Baby, and that's mostly because it was, like, an all-stars thing. Like, he was in it with two other really strong Hallmark actors, Tyler Hines and Paul Campbell. But other than that, like, his movies are usually not all that great. He's just fun to look at. But again, all of these sound really not good. And just based on track record, it seems like they've been putting the best one or the better ones of the week on Saturday. So, yeah, let's go with Christmas Island. But I am not excited about this weekend. Sorry to say. But that's okay because then, you know, the week after next, we're getting a whole bunch of fun ones. Like the Lacey Chabert and Scott Wolf Party of Five reunion movie is next Saturday. And Holiday Hotline, which sounds wonderful, about a guy who falls in love with the girl on like a recipe helpline, which I feel like this is a movie that I've seen before. Like it might be like a remake of an older movie. That one sounds really cute. So we'll see. So yeah, that's my recommendation for the week, but it's a soft recommendation. It's a soft recommendation. Please temper your expectations for these Countdown to Christmas movies. All right, I have no idea what the fuck I'm doing next week because, like I said, TV is like slim pickings. Real Housewives of Potomac starts tonight, Sunday, so by the time this comes out, it will have been on and streaming on Peacock. So maybe I'll cover some housewife stuff. Maybe I'll see if a guest wants to come on. Maybe I'll reach out to some guests and see if they want to talk housewives. Because we've gotten Beverly Hills, Miami, and Potomac all starting. So that's a little exciting. But yeah, other than that, there's not a whole lot happening. The Santa Clauses on Disney Plus, which I talked about last year and absolutely hated. But finished anyway. That's getting a season 2 somehow. And I'm hoping that they fix some issues. But betting that they did not. That's on Disney Plus on Wednesday. Yeah, that's about it. So let's keep our fingers crossed for an end to the strike this week, shall we? All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Fake TV Critic. I'll be back next week with more news, more recaps, more reviews, more analyses, and more recommendations. Have a great week, everyone.